Hi and welcome to the Ending Movie Podcast. This is one of those bonus episodes that I like to do every so often where I throw a call out to the internet and I get someone I find very interesting to come and talk to me about some recent films. This week I wanted to talk about the Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2, and I got Miss Jenny Amato, the West Coast editor for MovieLine.com, on with us. How are you doing today, Jen?
I'm good. I'm so glad, so excited to be talking to you across the magic of the internet.
Don't you love the internet? I mean,
it's amazing.
I was just talking to one of my coworkers the other day about how things were better back then, and I'm like, I think I would like to do a little vacation there, but I wouldn't want to live there because I wouldn't have internet.
I know, I wouldn't have so many things. Like, I would get lost everywhere because I would have no GPS telling me how to get home.
Yeah, that. Mm-hmm. I would probably just be sad that I couldn't YouTube clips of people like George Best and watch their football that I've never seen because I'm too young for that. But anyways, on to this subject of hand of Twilight and the Breaking Dawn. You, Miss Yamato, are one of the many proponents of the Twilight Saga on the internet. Am I wrong about that?
I've defended the Twilight Saga for like 4 years now. So I, and shamelessly so, I'm not embarrassed about it at all. I think like many, many Twilight fans out there, fans of the books and the films, I can recognize this franchise's flaws as well as embrace the thing that really resonates about it and is really entertaining. So, you know, Twilight fans are not dumb. They just love it. Much like fanboys love Star Wars, even if they don't love all of the Star Wars movies for good reason.
Don't you love it when people can pick and choose their love?
It's really fantastic. I think so.
But with this latest release, and the final of the franchise until it's redone in another 5 years. Breaking Dawn Part 2, we finally get to the point where Bella is a vampire and the movie goes 100% supernatural. I have been on the negative side of this franchise for the last, is it 5 years that it's been going?
Let's see, 2000, it's been 4 years.
4 years it's been going. I mean, I've had my fun with it, and I'm not really here to jibe you at all, but the...
I can take it. Dish it out.
I'm pretty sure that you've grown the skin over the last 4 years, if it wasn't there already. But I have to say that as much as I was looking forward to having a sigh of relief and saying, thank God it's over, I kind of enjoyed this version of it, where it went 100% ridiculous. I'd like to say that I was on board from pretty much like the third or fourth minute of this movie when she says, and I quote, "You nicknamed my daughter after the Loch Ness Monster." Mm-hmm. It's one of those movies where I feel the entertainment level outdoes any negative you can pull from it.
Yeah. I mean, and let's be honest, the franchise thus far, up until Breaking Dawn Part 2, has not had the sense of humor that Breaking Dawn Part 2 has. And I think that makes a big difference in making it more palatable to non-fans. But also, it acknowledges something in the franchise that we all see anyway, which is the inherent silliness of it. Of the dialogue, of the melodrama, of the supernatural aspect. And finally, Bill Condon, who directed both Breaking Dawn 1 and 2, and considers them both together one film, he finally gets to let this franchise be a little bit self-aware, and I think that makes a huge, huge difference.
Totally. I mean, the film is just filled with moments in which characters are embracing the over-the-top that it's been going at. I mean, I feel almost like what's been holding it back is that element of we're stuck in Bella's world, and because she isn't completely supernatural, we're not allowed to let the movie go to that level. So for example, when we're watching Bella play with her powers, there's a montage in like the middle of the film. And mm-hmm. we get to see Bella and even a lot of other characters that we've never met before, which includes one of my favorite actors who doesn't get to be in a lot of films, I find, Lee Pace.
Lee Pace is amazing. And how funny is it, at least here in the States, he was in Lincoln and Breaking Dawn in the same week, and he happens to play two characters who could have existed at the same time. If those two universes ever collided or overlapped.
He did mention that he was in some war, so maybe he is. I still haven't gotten to see Lincoln yet. I can't wait. All of those characters that they're introducing, and it feels almost, and this might sound like a negative, it feels almost like it's doing a Covenant kind of film.
You know what? It was funny. When I first read Breaking Dawn, the book, a couple of years ago, I read the ending to Breaking Dawn, and I thought to myself, this is unfilmable. I probably wrote that on the internet at some point. I thought it was actually unfilmable because of a few factors. One is it turns into what I describe as sort of an X-Men 3, The Last Stand kind of standoff between two armies of people with two armies of vampires and werewolves who have supernatural invisible powers, who in the books, those powers are described as sort of like invisible forces pushing against each other in the air. And I was like, how is anybody going to make this cinematic? Which I think Bill Condon did. The other problem that made it unfilmable was that nothing happens in the book. The battle is about to happen and people maybe are going to die, but then literally nothing happens and they turn around and walk away and go home at the end of the book. So, you know, I think the ending in the film, integrating all of these new cast members, the humor element, the new ending that Melissa Rosenberg wrote in, I think all of these additions injected a lot of really necessary new energy and really smart moves to this franchise. I mean, it works for me. I don't know about you. What did you think of the battle?
Well, firstly, just because I haven't read the book, obviously. But the way you said it right there, does the battle not exist in the book?
Yes, correct.
Wow, I can just imagine how
I read it, I
weird
like,
that is.
Seriously? The book, Breaking Dawn, is sort of contentious among the Twilight community for a couple of reasons. One being Bella's transformation, and another being sort of how it kicks everything up a notch into full-blown supernatural worlds. My problem with it, again, was how inert the ending is. What happens in the book is these two forces, right? The Cullens, the good vampires, and the Volturi, the bad vampires, they meet on the battlefield. They're about to fight, and then all of a sudden, Aro changes his mind. So what happens in the film is that they add sort of, you know, the explanation for why Aro changes his mind. And I tell you what, I saw it twice. I saw Breaking Dawn Part 2 twice. And the second time I saw it at the premiere, where they invited hundreds of Twilight fans to watch it, and they didn't know what was going to happen. And the screams... First of all, there were screams. There were regular Twilight screams throughout the movie, like any time Edward and Bella kissed, or, you know, the many times that Edward and Bella talk about, like, making sweet, sweet marital love. The time that Jacob takes his shirt off, they screamed. You know, these are like excited screams. But once the
battle... Oh, I know those screams.
Yeah. Those screams make every Twilight movie worth going to see in the theater. But when the battle began in Breaking Dawn Part 2, those screams turned to screams of horror. And it was the most amazing thing to witness. I loved it. It was like 10 minutes of constant screaming in horror. You could tell, you could hear it. Some of those Twilight fans were maybe on the verge of tears. It was just a constant 10 minutes of screaming. And it was amazing because for a book that all of these fans know inside and out so well, and they've lived with it for the past, like, 5 or 6 years, for them to be surprised at something that happens in the film adaptation of this book they know so well is a great gift. And, you know, at the same time, the way that the battle scene plays out, it plays on their emotional attachments to a lot of the secondary characters who don't get a lot of screen time. So I really think that change was really effective in many ways.
I do think that changed the way you describe it. It sounds like it added a lot to the film, because that last battle sequence is pretty much the icing on the cake for this film. Mm-hmm. I had a very different experience with this film, watching it in a theater, mainly because I went yesterday morning at around 10 in the morning to go and watch this movie. So it was a very thin crowd for a Twilight crowd.
What was the crowd like there?
There were screams. There were very intermittent screams, but most of them came during that battle sequence, and most of them were for almost every decapitation that occurred in that battle sequence. Someone just kept applauding and shouting, "Woo!" Like, "Oh, another Volturi just died." Okay. And it's kind of crazy. But what happened at the end of the sequence kind of took me aback when I saw the film, because I'm like, really? I mean, I get it.
By the way, can we talk about spoilers, or should we not talk spoilers?
I think we can hold for a few more minutes and then we can jump to spoilers.
I think we've done a good job not really spoiling anything so far.
Yeah, I mean, except for the Twilight fans who are like, just get to it, we've already read the book.
Oh, they know. They know.
They know. They're just like, oh, you're being coy.
Well, I know. I've spoken to a number of people who are all, maybe not coincidentally, non-fans, and men, who don't really like this franchise at all. They don't like anything about Twilight, who don't like the twist. Who think that it's a cheat. I've heard it described as a cheat.
I had that sort of feeling when I first saw, or when I finished watching it for the first time, because I'm like, oh, that's almost like, that's very akin to another movie, which if I call it out, it'll be completely spoiled. So I'll leave that for a second. In which I don't know anyone who didn't call it a cheat. But at the same time, I kind of like it because of how you explain it and how the book put it forward, into the fact that it's just giving us the explanation as to why Arrow, that's his name, right? I still call him David Bowie from Tron Legacy, even though I know it's Michael Sheen. Michael Sheen and the Volturi just walking away, going like, "Yeah, I think we should do this another day."
They're like, yeah, you guys, it's cool. Whatever. It's fine. Just kidding.
But I guess, I think my biggest complaint about this film, though, is that while I was willing to accept that, I think this movie drops down into, I don't even want to call it fan service. I think it's even lower than what fan service would be called, in its actual final scene, in which Bella gives us a recap, for lack of a better expression.
See, here's the thing I think about critiquing almost any of the Twilight movies, is that these are movies that are made for the fans. And every single Twilight movie has been pretty satisfying from a fan perspective, in that they've been incredibly truthful. They followed the book so faithfully. largely in part to due to Stephenie Meyer being actually involved in the films, and because the filmmakers and the studio Summit have known that the fans are not going to, you know, accept huge deviations from the book, from canon. So every single movie has been really faithful, and you know, even the ending to Breaking Dawn Part 2, which is what you're talking about. And even the, there's a post credit, not a post credits, but there's a credits roll that is basically an homage to the entire series, that sort of reminds you and credits, actors who we don't even see in Breaking Dawn Part 2, people who popped up in the first movie or the second movie or were recast by entirely different actors. And I think there's something really nice about that. It's Bill Condon has tapped into, I think, what the fan community wants and what they cherish about Twilight. And I thought it was really sweet. And I thought the way that they did that, the way they wrapped it up, leading into the credits with the scene that you're talking about, I thought it was just a really nice gesture. So, I mean, you may not want to be reminded of everything that's happened or how far Bella Swan has come, but I think it's worth noting that Bella Swan has really come a long way from where she was in the first Twilight film. And it's Breaking Dawn, Part 2, the movie, that finally sort of shows these cultural critics who have long criticized this character for being totally passive. It shows these critics that this is like what she's become, and she's become fully herself. She's become a strong, independent person of her own. She has, you know, her own special power or whatever, which was always within her, even as a human. She's chosen this life, and I think it's almost necessary to remind people out there that Bella has had this huge arc over the course of 5 films.
That is very true, but I feel like it's almost unnecessary. I mean, you're talking about these films being for the fans, and the fans will always be there, but haven't the fans sat through the first 4 films already? Don't we already know that?
Yeah, but this is a huge sign-off. They knew, you know, these are things that fans love. This is the kind of thing, like the part that you're talking about where it's they flash through.
Yeah.
That's the kind of, I think that's the part that made a lot of Twilight fans cry in Breaking Dawn. You know, cry tears of joy. Because they've lived with this series for 4 years now or more. And so it's a really sweet goodbye. I don't know. You would rather it have just ended?
I mean,
okay guys, bye.
I mean, to give a good example of it is, I think, the Harry Potter film, which gave a good nod to the whole thing at the end, where you get, and I guess I can say spoiler for Harry Potter, at the end of Harry Potter, where we get to see him and Malfoy and all of them there giving their children off to go to Hogwarts for the first time. And that being a great little nod to, this is a story which was so monumental and big for the fans, and this is just a little knowledge as to the future, as opposed to reminding us of everything that we've seen already. And I can pretty much bet that anyone who is there has probably sat through all of those movies in the last week, just rewatching them to go to the final movie.
So why would they not want to, you know, this final send off? Also, I should point out, I don't know if you know this, but that scene that you're talking about is actually in the book.
You mean the Harry Potter books?
No, in Breaking Dawn.
Oh, in Breaking Dawn. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that it has to be in the movie. I mean, we just spoke about the battle sequence wasn't in the book, but it's probably the biggest highlight in the film.
But if you don't have the scene in question, which we're talking about, that is in the book, that is literally the last scene in the book, like the last page of Breaking Dawn, the last page.
Which they have in the movie. The page in the book.
They do. I know. I mean, it's all for fans. It's not for people like you who, like, don't want to be reminded that they've had to cover Twilight movies for the past 4 years. it's for the fans who want to see, like, you know, faithfulness to Stephanie Meyer's original stories. And I mean, the thing that you're talking about specifically, the last scene between Edward and Bella, is also a pretty important, how do you say, it's a pretty important development between them in their relationship, you know? It's the one thing that she's never been able to do, or that he's never been able to have. It's the one thing that they've never been able to share between them. And only now can she allow that to happen. It's like their relationship has come full circle.
Okay, well, I think we can shout out spoilers at this point. Because we've been trying really hard not to say very specific things.
I know, we've been trying
so hard. So if you haven't seen Breaking Dawn Part 2 and you're looking forward to it, I think you might want to turn off right now, go and watch it and come back later.
Yeah.
I mean, but Jen, as a Twilight fan, you've finally gotten to see the finale. What were some of the best moments for you watching this film?
Actually, I would go back to what Stephanie Meyer and Melissa Rosenberg added in the adaptation from page to screen, in that we never see the battle scene in the book. So that was pretty fun. Mostly because it was a surprise, and mostly because they killed people. They killed characters who were dearly beloved in this franchise out of nowhere, and it was the most amazing surprise, and I really liked that. I thought it was pretty daring. And the humor element, which we also talked about. There's a scene between Charlie, who is Bella's father, and Jacob, Taylor Lautner, where Jacob transforms in front of Charlie to show Charlie that weird mystical things are out there in his normal boring world of Forks, Washington, that he can't explain, that he will just have to accept as fact. And it's a really funny scene where Taylor Lautner strips down, giving the fans the requisite six-pack shot. And I thought that was a really funny moment because it was funny. You got to see naked boys. And Taylor Lautner has really, I have to say, I think he's a much better actor now than he was many movies ago. Even better than he was in Abduction last year, which was kind of like the best worst movie of 2011. He was terrible in that movie, and he's kind of a lot, you know, like his acting has really matured, and I thought his comic timing was pretty good in that scene.
When I think of Abduction, all I can remember is the horrible line that the bad guy says to him, that he's gonna kill all his Facebook friends. I just remember that movie was horrendous.
I just, there's so many things I love in a totally ironic way about Abduction, and the dialogue really takes the cake. Any Taylor Lautner fan, I mean, they're probably gonna get mad at me for saying that, but It's so enjoyable. And he's not that great, and it's partly because the script is terrible, and the script has lines that make him literally say things like, "Are you my mother?" Things like that. Are you serious? But in Breaking Dawn, I feel like throughout it, a lot of the humor goes to him, to Taylor Lautner. And I think that's actually partly because humor is the one thing that can disarm all of the pedophilia jokes that come from Jacob's relationship with Renesmee, who is Bella's baby, her infant daughter.
Nessie.
Whom Jacob has imprinted upon. And imprinting is one of the great, fantastically weird concepts that Stephanie Meyer introduced in her Twilight saga, in which the members of the wolf pack, the werewolf shapeshifter Native Americans, who Jacob is one of them. One of their weird supernatural traditions is that they imprint on their soulmates. And they have no control over it. It's basically like love at first sight. It's described as a feeling, in the book it's described as a feeling of like being connected to somebody, like by like an invisible string, feeling that pull. So normally, I mean, in 99% of imprinting that we hear about in the books, and in the movies, it's romantic. But Jacob imprints on a baby, on a newborn baby, the moment that Nesty claws her way out of Bella's broken human body at the end of Breaking Dawn Part 1. So I think Taylor Lautner had the biggest challenge of Breaking Dawn Part 2 in making Jacob not seem totally, totally creepy. And I think the humor that they gave him to play it off was really essential, and I think they pulled it off too.
The imprinting thing, like, I kind of just took it as we're making him Godfather kind of a deal. He's gonna be the big...
Forward. It's this unnecessary flash forward that I actually think is maybe one of the bigger missteps in Breaking Dawn Part 2. There's a flash forward where they show in the future a vision of Bella and Edward, vampires, meeting up with their daughter Renesmee, who is now fully grown, and Jacob, who is imprinted upon her. And it's like Jacob and Renesmee at this point are finally able to date. So it's like a vision of Jacob's future romantic relationship with this baby. And I think it's the weirdest thing because A, they don't get another actress to play Renesmee. They age up using CG. Mackenzie Foy, who is like 11 years old or something, the actress who plays Bella's daughter in this movie. They take her face like they do with her baby face, her weird CG creepy uncanny baby face in this movie. They age her up to what she would look like when she was of a mature age, old enough to date Jacob, and that is like the creepiest part of Twilight for me. Is that
Are you serious? They did that?
Yeah, I don't know if you noticed that. That's like it's like a vision of the future. That like reassures Bella that everything's gonna be okay now, you know, at the end. Because, or maybe it's Edward who sees it from Alice, because Alice can see the future.
Yeah.
This series is so strange when I say it out.
I saw the scene and I thought it was weird generally as the idea of, is this just Jacob being next to her, being like, oh, I'm still Godfather and a really good friend? Or is it like, oh, this is now my wife and we're all family? Or
I think, I mean, they never like address that in the book, like the future of their relationship. But I think it's pretty safe to say they're going to fall in love and like be together once Renesmee is grown. And the introduction of the like other half human, half vampire character played by J.D. Pardo, who is on a television show here called, what is it called? It's about,
do you know? I know that name, J.D. Pardo.
J.D. Pardo, he's very pretty. He was in the Gwen Aron. What is that? He's
in Revolution.
Revolution, which also stars Billy Burke, who plays Charlie, incidentally. Anyways, the introduction of his character tells us the crucial piece of information: be fully grown and like fully mature in like 7 years or something like that. I forget how many years, but so it's going to be soon. You know, like soon she's going to, her accelerated growth will have blossomed her into a young woman of dating age, and she's totally going to be dating Jacob. And that's kind of weird. That's still like the weirdest thing to me.
I have to say that was kind of a nice moment for me when J.D. Pardo came out and they asked all of their questions, and Kristen Stewart asked about how long did it take for you to be like normal size, and you stayed as a mature individual, and they're like 7 years, and she's just like, yes, I won't have to worry about my child dying in my arms in like 5. And
yeah.
I kind of thought that was a nice little moment for her, as like quelling all of the worrying mother moments that were going throughout the movie.
Bella's maternal side is a really nice element, I think, here. That helps me forget that she's actually really still young. Like, Bella is basically a teen mom when she has Renesmee. She gets pregnant the first time she has sex, which sucks. And then she gets, then like Renesmee grows so fast inside her belly. It's not like it takes 9 months. It takes like, I don't know, like weeks. So she basically like reinforces every, nightmare pregnancy scenario that women can possibly have. So to see her like a happy mother, caring so intensely for her child is very nice. It makes motherhood seem much less terrifying than Breaking Dawn Part 1 does.
I have to say though, I watched Breaking Dawn a week prior to seeing this film, and I feel as though that movie could have just been an extra 40 minutes to Breaking Dawn Part 2.
But then they wouldn't be able to squeeze another $1 billion out of a second movie.
That's very true. But they needed the fans to pay for all sorts of cars and shit.
I think once the filmmakers and the studio figured out that there was a point, like a splitting halfway point, to break it into two movies, I think, it was a no-brainer. I mean,
I
and I
blame
blame.
Harry Potter for it.
Yeah, I totally blame Harry Potter.
They realized it worked financially for that film. They're like, "Yep, we can. There's not enough for two. I don't care. We'll do two Breaking Dawn movies." But I don't know. I've been reading a lot of reviews all over the internet, and I've been seeing a lot of positive responses. I don't know whether it's fatigue from critics who are tired of just being negative about this film, or if everyone's come around to the fact that it actually was that enjoyable for everyone to see this movie.
I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with it being technically a huge step up from the last few movies, or basically all of the Twilight movies that came before. And I do think it's technically the best Twilight movie. It's the best made, it's the best written, it's the best acted, of all of them. So I feel like, you can take a lot of these reviews genuinely. But I also think that at this point, years on into this franchise being a huge phenomenon and critics like pooping over every single one of these movies to date, I think they're almost just relieved that this movie isn't like as bad as they thought the other ones were. So I think there's some of that. It's not like you can review Twilight in a vacuum. Any of the Twilight movies, anything Twilight related.
I want to talk a little bit about the battle sequence and specifically about the decapitations, which has been a lot of mentioning online. People had this same discussion a few years back with the sequel to the Narnia movie, where there was a scene in which there was a pretty close-up decapitation. And everyone was complaining as to how can this movie be PG-13? Look at how the studios have aligned themselves so technically in order for the MPAA to have to give them a PG-13 rating while it contains all of these ridiculously gory ideas, even though they're not Suspiria level blood dripping every frame. And I mean, this is a franchise geared towards young adults. It's not really a movie meant for the 16-year-olds. It's meant for the 12 and 13-year-olds. How did you feel watching sequences like that where literally every other minute there was someone's head being fallen off and someone
Oh, I
being
was fine.
put on fire?
Totally fine. Totally fine with it. And part of it is because the way that Stephenie Meyer dreamed up these vampires, like vampire physiology in Twilight is so strange and so counter to any kind of vampire lore that we've known before. They're basically like living statues. So when you like break off a vampire's arm, which is possible, or their head, they can like reattach, I think, but that's what the fire is for.
So okay, if that's true, and I guess maybe this is my lack of memory, but when did they explain that in any of the Twilight movies?
Let's see. Maybe not the first Twilight movie. Maybe the second movie. I don't know. Somewhere along the line where you learned about Volturi, they explained. But basically, you have to like decapitate a vampire and then burn the pieces to truly kill a vampire. So, like, I think actually most of the decapitations were totally fine because they just look like statues, Like literally don't they're
It
not
kind of looks
bloody.
like somebody taking apart a Barbie doll.
Yes, it totally does. And I'm okay with that because I myself am pretty squeamish about bloody violence. I was just like giggling maniacally during the battle sequence. But I feel like the most violent kill in Breaking Dawn is what's his name? Jamie Campbell Bauer, one of the Aro's brothers, gets his jaw ripped off.
Yeah, the one, isn't that the one that Bella kills, I believe? I could be wrong.
No. This is Jamie Campbell Bauer, his character, the nomadic cousin. No, not the nomadic. The Cullen's cousins from the north. All the blonde girls basically
Okay.
rip off his jaw from rip the top of his head off basically. And I thought that was the grossest one, because it's also the most vivid one. Most of them are just like clean head rolling or whatever. But I thought that was the grossest one. I'm glad there were no like gory wolf fatalities, even though a couple wolves die in a, like cavernous pit or whatever.
It's all internal bleeding.
A lot of internal bleeding. So I feel like it's violent in that it's depicting a lot of violence, but it's not gory violence. And I feel like for me, it's gory violence that feels most inappropriate. So I was okay with it.
I mean, I think the weirdest one for me, and it's mainly because I almost didn't understand it when I saw it. Was a character who I think this is his first film in the franchise. One of the Volturi. He's like one of the higher ups, and I didn't get his name, but he's also in Hell on Wheels. I don't know if you've watched that show. Let me see if I
How did
can.
he die?
He kind of just realized that he was gonna die and just stood up, and it seemed like he spinned to death. For a second. That seemed like the most incomprehensible death that was in the film.
That's a Christopher Heyerdahl. Incomprehensible in that literally you don't understand except for the two Romanian vampires tear him apart. The reason he like gives up is because he's the Volturi who is sort of the saddest. He's like the most melancholic of these evil vampires, and he's kind of welcoming the end. So he gives up because he sees them coming, and he's like he's ready to die. He wants it. He's so sad.
He's just like, let me go back to Hell on Wheels and True Blood.
Yes, basically.
I was wrong. He was in all of the Twilight films in which the Volturi were mentioned.
Yes. He's one of the big three Volturi.
I just didn't remember him at all until I saw the film. And I'm like, maybe it's because I know I'm familiar with his face after seeing him on those two shows that I've mentioned. But I don't know if there's anything else really about this film or this franchise to talk about, but I guess the one question I really want to ask you, how has the experience for you been going through these last 4 years of people jibing at the thing you love?
I think I did the most defending Twilight in the around the time that the first movie came out and then the second movie came out. Because at first, the first Twilight was so new. People really loved to pile on. It became this like fanboy versus, essentially fangirl kind of cultural war. And then the second movie was hard as well because Bella is depressed and because, she is super passive and she is moping over boys, basically. So I understood why a lot of non-fans and a lot of other bloggers kind of hated her as a character and thought she was like an irresponsible role model for girls. But I know the books, I know the characters, I know the stories really well. And these movies have always been very gratifying from a fan point of view. So it's always been very enjoyable. It's still been very enjoyable, and it's been interesting to see how huge Twilight has become as a phenomenon, financially, as a franchise with merchandising, and like how even being cast in one of the movies, like Breaking Dawn, having no speaking parts at all, like a handful of vampires do in this last movie, can make a struggling actor instantly famous, at least Twilight famous. It's just like a part of being a part of the Twilight community. It's very inclusive. It's a very positive energy, and there's something really nice and special about that, that I think all the haters in the world can hate on it, and all the haters in the world can talk about how terrible Twilight is as a book or a book series or films, but the love that it has engendered and the connections and the community that has spawned because of it is I think it's a very positive thing, and so I really still like that about it. I think it's one of the best things to come of Twilight. So haters can hate, you guys can keep hating it. I know, it's fine.
I understand you completely, as I have to continually defend some of my many choices on the podcast week to week with my co-hosts, namely one being anything named Steven Soderbergh.
Ah, see, that's really interesting because there's totally a cult of Soderbergh too in the film community.
And I am one of those cult members who constantly drinks that Kool-Aid.
I get it. I get it. See? So everybody's got something. Twilight is not quite as easily defensible as Steven Soderbergh, but it's the same kind of thing. We're coming from the same place.
Jen, your Twilight is just my Soderbergh, that's all. So I guess I want to say thank you so much for coming on and talking Twilight with me.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've made my waking up early on Saturday to go to the cinema all worth it.
Totally worth it, right?
Totally
That
worth
and
it.
screaming.
Oh, the screaming. Oh, the screaming. Especially when Dakota Fanning got killed.
Oh, I love that. Dakota Fanning didn't get a lot to do in this entire series, but the moment that she like realizes that she's gonna get her ass handed to her and starts running is kind of a great moment. I love that.
So Jen, before we go, do you want to direct anyone on the internet to somewhere special?
Somewhere special. Sure. The most special place on the internet is clearly Twitter. So please follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JenYamato. And then check out Movie Line to see me write about everything.
I'm sure you're eagerly awaiting the Twilight reboot so you can start those articles again.
Man, I hope they don't read Twilight. I cannot imagine. I can't imagine. I can't go through this again. Twice in my lifetime.
So everyone, thank you for listening, and I guess I have to end the podcast the way my co-hosts tell me to. Please don't watch bad movies, and good night.
I won't let them destroy